Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Lengafam podcast. My guest today is Jonathan Downey, an interpreter, interpreter trainer, interpreter researcher, and author. I suppose I've forgotten a few things, but we'll talk about it, who joins us from Scotland today. Hello, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Enjoying the overcast sunshine.
Yeah, same here in Brussels. It's a rainy day. So you're joining us from Edinburgh today?
Yep. Yes.
Great. Lovely city. I've been there, I think, once or twice and immediately fell in love with the city. It's really, really beautiful.
It's an incredible city. It's slightly more expensive than you would like, but it's a lovely, lovely city. And I'm close enough to the zoo that I can go and visit the monkeys whenever I want. It's exactly like watching conference interpreters work.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself first? So you're an interpreter. You wear different hats, so maybe you just get started with the interpreter hat to keep things simple.
Yeah. I've been an interpreter officially since 2007, but like a lot of people in the UK, it took me a while to get my first job. I don't think I actually got my first job until about a year and a half after I started practicing. So I ended up doing a lot of translation, bugging agencies, going back to agencies, because in those days I didn't realise that direct interpreting clients existed. And I didn't and still don't have enough languages to apply to the EU, to the European institutions. That's something I'm working on at the moment. And so eventually when I started getting work, I realised that certainly outside of London, the UK market can't sustain you being full-time as an interpreter. So you have to look at what else can I do? Where else can I add value? Where else can I help? So I still do a little bit of translation. I get paid to do research projects, which is always fun. And as from sometime next year, I will be a published author with a book that's coming out with Routledge.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the book a bit later on. Just to talk about the translation, because with some people, interpreters who do translation on the side, as it were, it's sort of looked down upon as if it were a second-class activity, which I think it is not, because I've done some translating as well. And I always thought it was a very good complement to interpreting. I mean, both are very good for each other, I think. What do you think about that?
I think they help each other, but not in the ways that we would expect. I think it keeps my French a lot fresher because I'm working with it more often. But the strange thing is that the kind of work that I do, the kind of fields I work in interpreting and the kind of fields I'm working in translation have gone in two entirely different directions.
Okay.
In interpreting, where I'm trying to go is more PR, press conference style things, but I've done a lot of not European institution work, but work generated by the institution, so lobbying, policy fora, all of that sort of thing. And then European Works Councils, which are probably the most nightmarish job that interpreters can have.
Yeah, I've heard of those. I've never done one myself. But, yes, the stuff of nightmares, I guess.
Most of the interpreters' scare stories will come from EWCs. You get some really nice ones, and then you have ones that have the potential to flare up nastily, and you're really glad you're behind plexiglass. You just wish it was bulletproof. But my translation work has been a bit more in marketing, a bit more. I'm starting to go from translation into proofreading, editing, and a little bit of copywriting as well, mostly because I realised that the skills that you need as a good translator, especially if you're kind of doing marketing stuff, or my last large job was a research job for a cosmetics company where I spent kind of 2 weeks Googling skin conditions and wondering if that was what colour it actually was when someone had it. You have to be able to write in a way that people will understand, that can get across the style of the original writer. And I thought actually that works a lot for copywriting, where it's very easy as a translator to just be faithful to the source text and not think about the reader. When you get into thinking about the reader, you're heading more and more towards transcreation and copywriting, which is something that I'm beginning to move more into now as well, just because I actually enjoy it more than translation, but not as much as interpreting.
Okay, so you have the priorities very straight there.
Yeah, I like anything that involves actually being in regular contact with people is good. Anything that involves being able to sit at my desk in my pyjamas is not so good. I actually must admit, for the first kind of 2-3 years of my career, I struggled a lot with translators' loneliness, because at that point my wife was working full-time most of the time. I hadn't heard of networks. Well, I'd heard of ITI, and I was a member of ITI, but I didn't know what to do to actually meet other people. So I would sit at my desk in shorts and t-shirt, chatting to our pet rabbits while bidding for prose jobs. And if that doesn't drive you insane, nothing will. I was so glad when I started the PhD and actually met people. it was quite good to get out there, and I think that's where the PhDs, and another way that the PhD has been helpful, is it's allowed me to get in contact with other people, other interpreters, and then from there I started thinking, oh, what about other translators and interpreters, and started getting more involved in ITI and more involved in different things that would just get me out of the house for a change.
So how did you actually become an interpreter? Was that always a childhood dream, or was it pure happenstance? And then how did that evolve?
That's a long, bizarre story. When I was about 14, I'd been learning French since the age of 8 because my dad spoke fluent French. I'd worked in the railway, spoke fluent French, loved it when they got tourists in the train station. I wanted to be an interpreter from about 14 when I watched people doing it at Christian youth conferences. I think I was about 15 where suddenly they said, you speak decent French. I was like, yeah, c'est pas mal. And from those four words, I got put on in the city centre of Brighton in front of 200 young people and anyone who was passing by, while this other teenager shared his life story in French, sentence by sentence. And so I did a sentence by sentence consecutive live in Brighton Town Centre, having never interpreted before. And from then I just caught the bug. Unfortunately, a careers advisor at school gave me bad advice, and I thought I couldn't actually become an interpreter until I was doing my year abroad in Dunkirk, where they speak the French equivalent of Glaswegian, and saw an advert for the Harriet Watt course and went, oh, I can do it with just two languages, right, I'm there. Went to the Harriet Watt course and really never looked back. The MSc made a huge, huge difference to me, and I fell in love not just with the practice, but with studying the practice. All because of a guy called Ian Mason, who was an amazing professor, still going now, an absolutely fantastic professor who started thinking, well, if translation and interpreting is about language, what can our knowledge of language do to help translators and interpreters? And just completely swept away the field with his work. And his passion and openness and honesty about how much we don't know just really caught me by surprise as well. And I got into studying interpreting too.
And so you studied in Edinburgh then, at Harriet Watt's?
Yeah, I studied at Harriet Watt. And my English to French tutor is actually still there. She's now one of the professors. So I must not have worried her too much.
I don't know if you can say, but what was your favourite part about studying?
My favourite part about studying, I think, was probably... There are two. One is booth time. I loved being in the booth, especially when we got a really interesting talk to do. We have these things called mini conferences where from your second semester, they do mock conferences every single week. And everyone on the course is expected to be there, interpreting or speaking. And the mini conferences I just thought were fantastic. But I also loved the fact that there wasn't a huge amount of lectures, so I got to spend an awful lot of time in the library just randomly reading things. And I think... what makes a good interpreter is someone who can't get enough information about whatever. I've met so many interpreters who could quite happily just sit and browse random Wikipedia articles for hours on end.
Oh yeah.
Just in case left-handed brown squirrels comes up in their next assignment.
Yeah, you never know when you can use it.
Exactly. I used to love browsing random chemicals on Wikipedia until I realised that I was probably going to get on the NSA blacklist.
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to build a bomb or anything.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, okay. So during the course of your study, did you spend some time abroad? Is that part of the normal structure of the training?
It was part of my undergraduate degree, which was in English and French literature, which, to use a British phrase, was about as useful as a chocolate teapot. But I did seven months in Dunkirk in the north of France.
Okay, that was that, yeah.
Yeah, that was that, and that was great. I got, while I was there, because he'd seen me interpret all once before, they gave me another tryout, and then I did my first conference while I was there. They had a European youth conference in the church that I was part of while I was there, and so I was interpreting for another kind of 100-odd people. I think I did about 3 or 4 sessions, because I did all of the French to English and someone else did all of the English to French, all in on stage consecutive, without notes. I'd never been trained before. And my thing is, if you can do that interpreting once, you're either going to love it and never want to stop doing it, or hate it and never want to do it again. And I just fell into the first category.
It's like a make or break experience.
Well, exactly, because, you know, mad things happen at youth conferences, and you just have to learn how to think on your feet. I still have the recordings of it somewhere, and I cringe badly at my performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, my first live interpreting performance at a conference I have on CD.
Yeah.
And, I got, I mixed up, because I was doing French to English, and he said croyance, and I thought he said croissance.
Oh, all right.
So, yeah, little things like that just really, really bug me now, and how close I was to the French word order bugs me as well. But, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah.
They can teach a lot at university, but I've noticed experience has taught me a lot more than you could possibly learn in the classroom.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Like, when to go macro, when to kind of lengthen your lag and go, you know what, I'm not even going to attempt to get everything he's saying. I'm going to get the main message that he's giving. And I'll be much better doing that than trying to get every single detail, because everyone's going to fall asleep if they get the details.
Exactly. It's much more useful for your client or for the listener. That's for sure, yeah.
Yep.
So I believe you also did, or do, interpreter training. Do you still do that at Heriot Watt's?
No, I don't train at Heriot Watt, but what I'm beginning to do now and what I'm planning to do off the back of the book is to start doing kind of paid-for interpreter training for those who are already in the profession. In Warsaw this year, yeah, at the Translation and Localization Conference in Warsaw this year, I did a session on public speaking for interpreters, and an awful lot of it was getting people to tap their own experience that they've seen and heard in the booth and go, okay, if you know what works when you're in the booth, let's get you to do that same thing. And I said one of the problems that I've noticed is that often we'll default to what we know doesn't work, because that seems to be what we hear all day.
Mm-hmm.
We might hear a great speaker maybe once or twice a year and don't realize that's where we should be heading, not the average speaker that we're interpreting for every assignment.
That's definitely true, yeah. Especially in the institutional context that I work in, yeah, it's definitely true.
There's a reason why they call it an institution, maybe.
Absolutely.
But I think that's the thing, is that I started by kind of chatting to academics about it, but I realized that interpreters... One of the things that I'm talking about in the book is that the institutional market is where we're all trained to go to as interpreters, but no matter how much the European institutions hire interpreters, supply will always outstrip demand. So the vast majority of interpreters will have to find their clients elsewhere. And my argument is, well, let's find out how those clients tick. You know, we already know largely what the institutions want. Let's find out how the non-institutional clients tick. And it just so happens that many of them seem to want to meet you face-to-face, seem to want you to be able to present your business in 20 seconds,
mm-hmm.
Or might want you to do a presentation to the boss. So you have to be able to carry yourself with the same assurance and the same confidence as you would in the booth, even when you're being a business person. And my experience certainly is that most interpreters are much less confident carrying themselves as a business person than they are as an interpreter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, thankfully, we have a few... colleagues who deal with that, like Marta, for example, who does a lot of business focused training. So I think that's good, but certainly a potential that can be developed. Yeah.
Yep.
So how did you make the transition then from maybe not being a student, but then a graduate and a budding interpreter to the PhD into research?
Funnily enough, as I was walking through a set of double doors in our department, I suddenly had this thing. And as a Christian, I really felt it was a God thing saying, I need to stay and do a PhD. And I ignored it at that point because, you know, the standard thing is finish your degree, get a job. It was after about 2-3 years when I'd struggled with translator's loneliness, wondering what was going on, I realised that I was defaulting to, I know some people default to, when they have a quiet day, do some marketing. When I had a quiet day, I was reading interpreting research, which wasn't helping my business development at all. But I realised that I was actually far happier doing that than I was bidding for prose jobs. I would find out later that there are far better ways to market your services. But I suddenly realised that actually I was more passionate about improving my practice by research than I was in, you know, going out to business networking and trying to explain to people that, no, I was not an interpretator. I was not any form of potato.
A simultaneous translator.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Please don't. I just ask people how fast they actually think I can type. And so... And then what happened was I started the PhD wanting to look at the difference between on-stage consecutive and simultaneous. And I realised about 6 months in that wasn't going to work. And what was really interesting to me was what the clients actually want.
Mm.
And so I ended up, I concentrated on church interpreting since basically that's where I started. And I found so many commonalities between church interpreting and institutional interpreting and public service interpreting. It's totally crazy how many common things there are. And I just asked the question, you know, what do the stakeholders of church interpreting actually want from interpreters? And it turned out the answers surprised me in more ways than one. And one of the answers became the seed of the book, which I'm now finishing off for Routledge, with the idea that we tend to look for clients who need us. But, you know, if I need to change a light bulb in my house, I'm not going to go and pay £100 for a light bulb because I just want light. That's all I want.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I'm buying a computer, it's not just a need, it's something I want because I obviously want the computer to do a certain thing and I can see how it's going to add value to my business. So I'll pay far more and be more interested in going up market in a computer than I would in a light bulb. And it just so happened that traditionally we've been selling interpreting like light bulbs. You know, everyone must have an interpreter if you have a foreign language. And so, of course, people are going to pay as little as they can.
Hmm.
We're selling it on the basis of need, not want. The book then takes you through the journey of what does it mean to get people to want interpreting and how do we get to that stage?
Yeah. I'm thinking of this one article you published in the VKD Kurier, which is the internal publication of the German Association of Conference Interpreters, which was precisely about that, about church interpreting. Can you maybe tell us a bit more? Do you do that on a regular basis? Or
I used to do it more than I do now. It's a strange thing that most of my career I've been in churches that don't need it, and I've ended up doing it for special events and conferences. End of last year, I was doing it for a French guest speaker, and it sounded like it was going to be a large event, and then it became a small one. So it really tested my ability to adapt my prep. But my first experience with interpreting was church interpreting. And for about 2-3 years, I was getting a lot of booth time. Just, you know, my local church had an influx of Francophone Africans come to the church from various countries. And suddenly I'm having to work out, you know, under what circumstances can chuchotage work? Under what circumstances do you need to be on stage consec? Under what circumstances do we need to find another solution? And I think church interpreting makes you pose the hard questions about interpreting, especially things like where an established church just suddenly gets interpreting. You go, right, how do we fit this into what the organization's already doing? As opposed to there's a church that I know in Germany, in Bonn, where interpreting has been part of their DNA almost since the beginning, to the point where line one of their constitution is, in German, we are an international church, and so we have interpreting. Line one of the constitution. And that completely changes how they view interpreting, completely changes how they look after their interpreters, completely changes what they expect of their interpreters. And so when I went to do research there, I felt that I was learning from them as much as they were learning from me.
And what did it look like? Did you interpret the whole service?
Mostly, this is where it gets a bit funny, because my experience was an awful lot of conferences, and so you would just interpret the sermon.
Okay.
And often the offering time as well, because the church group that I was in for a while would make a big deal out of the offering. And what you would end up doing is you would end up jumping about like a Maddie to praise and worship, because it was a charismatic church, which tend to be quite loud. And then you'd be straight into the booth. And so you would have to get used to shifting roles very, very quickly.
That's what I found so interesting about the article, because I think the way you put it is that interpreters are part of the show. Or I think that's the way they put it, even.
Yep.
Because you're not just there as a neutral medium, and, you know, language A comes in at one side and on the other side language B comes out. It's much more, yeah. And did you find that you could use that for other assignments as well? Or was that very, very particular to church interpreting?
Well, I'm beginning to appreciate more of that. That interpreters are part of the show actually comes from an Italian study into sports interpreting, where professional interpreters were being sacked because they were interpreting neutrally and weren't, it wasn't working, so they used presenters instead. And so I just borrowed that phrase because I thought it's such a nice phrase.
It is.
And it shows, I mean, it seems to apply in sports interpreting, it seems to apply in media interpreting, certainly in church interpreting it does. And there are some assignments where you need to be aware of that. So there's a story in the book where I was interpreting for a manufacturer of construction equipment. They basically made large trucks of various kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been briefed that it was just them speaking to their own organisation. And it turned out, actually, no, it's not. It's their own organisation and the press relations job.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time we sat in the booths, there were a team of about 8 of us in the end, 4 booths in the end. And we suddenly realised we have to get this right. And so certainly I know the French booth, my colleague Laura and I, who I trained with as well, we switched into, okay, this is press relations. We are going to be marketing people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when the sales guy stands up, we become salespeople. They don't want us to do neutral, you know, just chill out and get the content across. They want us to find a way of bringing across their enthusiasm in a way that's relevant for the audience. And that, you know, you could argue that you're still neutral, but at the end of the day, you're taking responsibility for the success of what happens.
And it's a different mindset in a way, I think.
Yeah, I looked up about a year afterwards, I looked up and realized that they got a really good write-up in the French press, and I thought, yeah, that's because we cared.
Excellent.
And I feel like where we need to be going with interpreting, arguably even in the institutions, in fact, Morven Beaton's found out that the institutional interpreters do it without realizing, is that we need to care about the outcome of the event that we're at. We need to make it a personal thing. You know, it's not, if it's just a job, then we won't do the same kind of work as if we think, hold on, we're responsible, at least partially responsible for this working. And that applies in all forms of interpreting, whether you're doing court interpreting, medical, conference, wherever. The interpreter should have a stake in the success of the event.
That is definitely true, and I, especially in my context here as well, in the institutions, and I think you referred to it at some point to high stakes, low stakes. But even if it's low stakes or a perceived low stakes event, I think just caring about what they talk about a bit more makes it more interesting for you and more engaging. And it's because sometimes, I mean, let's face it, some meetings can be quite boring. But if you sort of try to be more involved and try to be interested in it and try to care about it more, I think that makes the work much more rewarding, and it definitely makes our results much better in the end.
I think one of the things I'm noticing is the difference between high value and low value. And I mean, I've been warned by my supervisor not to give too much away, because we've got a paper coming out, we've got a paper that we're working on. But high value interpreting is where the clients realise that basically, not without you, the event couldn't have been as much of a success as it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we were joking earlier about, you know, the traditional thing we tell interpreters, make it be so good it's as if you weren't even there. Well, the problem with that is that people are going to stop paying you eventually. The logical conclusion is use machine interpreting. When people realise that not only are you there, not only did they understand, but something happened, then I think that makes a difference. And this is where, it's what I'm talking about in the book, it's what I'm now talking about in research, is wherever I go, I'm now talking about it. And it's because the more I read research and the more I even try some of this in my own practice, the more I realise this works. There's another story in the book. A couple of weeks ago, I was at an events industry kind of show thing. So you had all these events industry guys and hotels trying to sell you rooms and convention centres and stuff. And I was talking to this guy who was into, he organises sports events. And talking to him, I realised that what he had been getting was his uncle or his cousin or whoever he could find to interpret and just, you know, give me the language. What he actually wanted and needed was someone who cared enough to go, all right, I see where your event's trying to go, let me help you make it work.
Yeah.
And as soon as I said, yeah, that's the kind of interpreting I do, his eyes lit up and he went, give me your email address. And I thought, well, you know, if it's that easy to just say to the client, see the thing that you're actually wanting, that's what we can give you. And that's what we like to give you. But the problem is to do that, we have to deal with about 50 years worth of tradition because of where professional interpreting as we know it started. And it's not quite Oedipal. We're not trying to kill off the founders of interpreting. We're just having to realise that we're not in the 1950s anymore. And so the ethics laid down by Seleskovich and that in the 60s and 70s are wonderful and great for their time, and the AIC 1950s ethics were fantastic for their time, but we're now in the 2010s. The game has changed. Fundamentally, the game has changed. It's not that we need to abandon everything we had before, but we need to rethink what are the terms for today? What are the rules of engagement for interpreting today? Translation has done it superbly, I think, in the past 10, 15 years. They've really turned around and said, okay, we are a service industry, let's deliver a service. I just wish interpreting would suddenly realise, we're a service industry, let's deliver a service. We're a bit slower, and no one has quite convinced me why we're that much slower, because translation had to get over the same ethical issues as we did.
That is a very good question, yeah, because we all realise that, I think, that interpreters seem to be a bit slower when it comes to adapting, you know, technology, which is my particular focus. But that's an excellent question, why that is. But I, from the top of my head, I cannot think of anything that would be a convincing reason for that slowness.
I mean, The only one that I may have found is there's this mythos around institutional interpreting, which you'll probably be well aware of, is that if we're trained to fit the EU mould, we have to be told what those standards are. And for a while we were convinced, and even researchers were convinced, that the EU standard was this perfect neutrality, perfect terminological accuracy, invisible interpreter thing. And then Morven Beaton did her PhD on interpreting of the EU, and I don't know which interpreter she did, she probably doesn't know because it's all anonymised anyway, and found out that perhaps without recognising it, EU interpreters systematically downplay any ideologies contrary to the EU ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So they're already taking a position.
Yeah.
And so when there's a realisation that, hold on, they're taking a position anyway, suddenly I think if we can have this ideological shift that we're always taking a position, even if we don't realise it. I've got a blog post coming out on the 12th where I've said, you know, if we say we're not taking a position, we're defaulting to the position of the most powerful client.
Yeah, it's true.
And so if we can actually get that into our heads that as soon as we have this default position of we're not taking a position, we're actively hurting the weaker client.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the institutional context, it probably doesn't, you've probably not got the same dynamics, but certainly if you're working in public service or court interpreting, that has to matter to you that that's what you're actually doing.
Yes.
And I think in professional conference interpreting, certainly where I see the industry going, if we play this invisible interpreter card for too much longer, we will be replaced and it will be our own fault.
And nobody will notice.
No one will notice. And you know, we've had this argument about remote interpreting, and the research on remote interpreting is it does seem to cause more stress. Whether it causes long-term issues, no one knows yet. Whether it causes accuracy issues, no one's clear.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want to argue that we have to be in the room, we have to have a convincing argument for that, and saying it will raise my blood pressure is not going to convince any client.
Yes. Yeah.
Our clients do not care about our long-term health. They probably shouldn't. Because, you know, they're not paying for our doctor's bills.
Well, not directly, at least, yeah.
Yeah, not directly. They're coming and they're paying us to come and do a job.
Exactly.
And so if we can say to them, look, if we're there, we'll have the same access to what's going on as you will, and we will be able to have the same commitment to the event as you will and make it better, then they'll pay the extra however many £1,000 to put booths in. If we say, if we're there, it'll raise my blood pressure, they'll go, oh, well, see you at home. You know, it's simple as that.
Yeah. The book you're not writing, you've finished writing it by now, I think, but was it a natural development building on the foundation of your PhD? How did that come about?
It was a natural development of reading a lot of research. And what happened was I've been a columnist for the ITI Bulletin, which is kind of an industry publication in the UK. ITI is the biggest specialist translation interpreting association in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
The then editor gave me a column, which I've been writing for 3 years, looking at research into practice. How do you turn what researchers are doing into something that will improve your practice in some way, whether it's get you more money, get you more efficient, or whatever. So I'd started writing that.
Mm-hmm.
Got a column in the Falkirk Courier about a year ago, I think.
Yeah.
And suddenly I realised that most of what I was writing was about the same subject. I was really coming at this adding value thing from a million different angles. And I thought, well, hold on. I kind of chatted with my wife, and male interpreters will tell you that wives are fountains of wisdom. And I said, you know, I've been writing about this stuff all the time. I said, maybe I should write a book, but I don't know if anyone will buy it. And she just looked at me and said, write the book, please. In fact, I think her words were something like, why haven't you already started writing?
Yeah.
Which is incredibly wife to say. And I just sat down and wrote, and about three or four chapters there that I could write almost without looking at the keyboard, that the stuff was just there.
Yeah.
A couple of the chapters, like there's a chapter on interpreter health, which, as I joke, you know, I went to a physio because I had bad knees, and he just fixed his glare at me and said, your problem is your job, Mr. Downey.
Yeah.
You know, he asked me if I did exercise. I said, well, every so often I'll run to the shared printer at uni. Does that count? And apparently that doesn't count as exercise. And so the health chapter, I had to sit down and get help from Camille Kellogg, who I interview, who's an expert on interpreter nutrition, read the studies and go, okay, what does it take to be a healthy interpreter? it turns out it takes time and commitment and effort, but oh well.
Too bad.
Yeah, it means that we actually have to exercise, which is a bit strange for interpreters to think about. And some of the other chapters took more effort, but it was worth it in the end to come away with the final draft is going to the publishers next week, to come out with something that I'm confident is not going to go out of date as soon as it comes out in print.
Right.
And my aim was to write something that people could instantly use. So the chapters are, no chapter is longer in total than about 5,000 words.
Okay.
So the idea was you can read a chapter on the way to an assignment,
uh-huh.
and every chapter ends with questions to ask, which is where I get people to test their assumptions and to ask, okay, not just how am I practicing interpreting, but why am I practicing it that way? And are there areas which I can become self-aware enough to go, that has to change. And then there's a putting it into practice, and that's in two sections. One is just personally. So you might get things like personal things that I can give people on improving their marketing, or there's one or two very quick tips that I found on improving your health, such as switching your breakfast. And then there's kind of mostly the things to do on yourself are relatively short term. And then there's things to do in a group which tend to be longer term, which is where I realised that we're not going to change interpreting on our own. We need the European Commission and European Institution interpreters to work with the sign language interpreters, to work with the court interpreters, to sit there and go, okay, we each have our strengths and weaknesses. You know, it's easier for the European Institution interpreters to get access to the people who have the power.
Mm.
It's far more difficult for sign language interpreters to do that. So there should be a way of us using the different skills at different kind of interpreters build and saying, okay, let's work together to improve the value that we add to our profession, because we all benefit as the status of the profession grows. There's a quip in there that, you know, if you're a staffer at the moment, you might feel like you're on the top of the pile and you're fairly secure.
Mm.
But the growth of the right wing in Europe suggests that it would only take one word from a certain kind of politician to, you know, ask the EU why it's wasting money on interpreting, and suddenly the House of Cards begins to tumble. And so absolutely no one is secure at the moment. And so if we can get that in our heads, no one is secure, I think we can start working from a better foundation, and people can start going, okay, what benefits do I have? You know, some interpreters are amazing at lobbying. Other interpreters can get straight to the European Commission and get listened to. Well, okay, can we combine those strengths? Let's work together. And I mean, I still find it odd that we have an International Translators Day on St. Jerome's Feast Day, but no one's ever thought of an International Interpreters Day. Really simple things like that would help us add value to our profession really, really easily, and would solve the upcoming crisis. I mean, the European institutions have been warning about a crisis coming with native English speakers. Well, you change that together. You fix that together. You don't fix that by railing at governments. You fix that by saying, okay, schools, how can we help? That's what you do.
What you do as a profession as a whole, yeah.
Yeah. And as an individual as well. I mean, I would love to get back into my old high school and say, guess what? People from the west of Scotland can be successful.
So if you compare writing the PhD and writing the book, I mean, definitely it must have been different, but was it maybe liberating to write the book because you had fewer constraints maybe? Or how would you describe the difference between writing a rather strict research project and a PhD and the book, which seems to be, I don't know how to put it, but how would you describe the difference?
The book certainly has more jokes in it and is more of my conversational style.
Yes.
The book has more jokes in it because I interview Matthew Perret.
Oh, okay. Well then.
Who is just, the man is a genius.
He is.
But with the PhD, I mean, at the moment, say I'm having a discussion with my supervisors over one sentence in my PhD, and that level of discussion is good because, you know, it's going to be, my external examiner is a man called Franz Pohacker,
yeah,
who most interpreters know,
yes,
and he has a reputation, so you don't want to mess up.
Absolutely.
And so that is strict, but the rigor from that I could use in the book, because then I could go, okay, even my supervisor says that I have this nasty habit of questioning assumptions. And so with the book, the first chapter I wrote was on ripping up neutrality and adding value. And that came from the rigor of the PhD going, okay, I'm not going to say something that I don't have the evidence to say.
Yes.
If the evidence isn't there, it doesn't go in the book. And so literally while there may be one paper, two papers quoted per chapter, I can guarantee you that behind that behind most of those chapters are at least five or six, or in the case of the first chapter, about 30 different studies. Mm. And so I'm not sure that there may be a further reading section for each chapter where I just say, look, go look at it yourself and find the evidence your way. And that's that kind of rigor and that kind of tenacity to not give up when you hit a snag. I mean, there was quite a late issue with the book which delayed it. You know, the tenacity of doing a PhD and going, this is going to be finished, meant that you have to find a solution. I almost wish that every interpreter would do a PhD just because, for two reasons. One, because it gives you the time and space to think about your own practice.
Yes.
And reflect a lot more on what is true and what isn't true. And the second thing is because we wouldn't fall... The rigor from that, I think, changes your research for a job into another gear, and changes the way you approach your work into another gear, because you suddenly realise that you have to throw everything in the air and see how it lands. You can't just go, oh, I've done this job before, I'll just do it the same way as last time. You say, okay, what did I learn from last time? What did and didn't work from last time? What might the client want this time that's new? And doing a PhD gives you that mental toughness to be able to look at your own work and go, you know what, that's garbage, but I can do better.
Questioning assumptions or perceived wisdom.
Well, there's a line in the book where I say that there's something about a master's degree that makes it difficult for you to look for help. Doing a PhD means that you're entirely looking for help throughout the 3 or 4 years. No PhD, I mean, you write that it's all your own work, which it is. But on the other hand, you have supervisors who are helping you. You have other researchers who are helping you. And suddenly, when you're in that thing of, I couldn't have done this without help as an interpreter now, I'm like, well, you know what? I desperately need to look for a mentor. I desperately need to find a way of improving my French public speaking skills. You know, there are things in my professional interpreting which I now know, you know what, I'm going to be humble enough to ask for help.
Yeah.
And find the people who can give it to me. And that's why, you know, Routledge suggested that and titled the book The Successful Interpreter. And I'm like, please don't title it that because I'm not successful yet. You know, I'll be successful when I reach the level of the people I'm trying to reach.
Yeah.
But doing the PhD has made me realise, you know what, it's okay to say, guys, I'm not coping. Can someone help me? Or this area isn't working. Can I get help? I don't know if they encourage that in the European institutions, but certainly as freelancers, it can be incredibly difficult to put your heart on your sleeve and just say, you know what, this isn't working. Someone help me fix it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely still a touchy subject, but it seems to be changing as a new, I don't know, not a new generation, but as new blood simply moves in and changes things around. Yeah, because I've always been very much about, you know, being open and transparent and also, you know, discussing your own performance, your own flaws, but it doesn't really run in our veins as interpreters, I think. Unfortunately, I think it's a shame. Well, we're losing out on something.
This is the thing, there's a group on Facebook called Community of Practice, which was started after a webinar series that I ran through a company called ECPD. Mm-hmm. And the lady who runs ECPD just created this Facebook group called Community of Practice. It's fairly quiet, but the aim of that is that people can just post a thing and say, you know, I've shared a bit about the book, but one of the questions that I said was, you know, what one thing would you change about your interpreter university training? Mm. And it's amazing what you get. And then a question that I'm probably going to pose this week is, if you could change one thing about your practice now, what would you change? And the follow-on question from that is, okay, how are you going to change it? And to get used to the fact that Elisabeth Tesselius, who I interview in chapter 3 of the book, as an expert on interpreter development, found out in her PhD that she looked at some staff interpreters with the European institutions who, after 20 years of experience, were interpreting worse than they did when they were at university.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And so...
It's sad, but true.
Yeah. Her question was, well, why? Because that shouldn't be happening. And it turns out that most other fields where they have recognised experts, from doctors to sports people, they become that by what's called deliberate practice, which is practice with a coach,
yes,
or with a mentor. Not 10,000 hours just practicing. It's with practice that isn't your daily work, with a coach or a mentor who specifically designs things for you to work on.
Hmm.
So, you know I need to work on my French public speaking skills. I should be getting, you know, I have an English public speaking coach. I should be getting a French one now saying, you know, drilling me on introductions and conclusions and on how French people think. That's where I need to be going. Maybe other interpreters, you know, oh, your decalage management's a bit weird. Okay, do some practice stuff, find another interpreter, get them to drill you on it and give you specific exercises so that you can adapt your decalage to what you're doing. Or maybe your terminology research sucks. Well, get someone to give you exercises on that.
Mm.
It's actually a strength to find a better interpreter and say, you know, I'm going to find a better interpreter about business skills and say, okay, teach me how to get clients. And I tell you what, when I get clients, I'll hire you as well. You know, quid pro quo.
Yeah.
Literally giving them quid back. But that's, I think that's absolutely where we need to be going, is let's get mentoring into interpreting. Let's get coaching into interpreting. And let's get to the point where the next time someone does a study and compares us after 20 years of experience, they go, you know what? They're the interpreter version of Mozart and Picasso. And when you're still at school, you're the equivalent of someone playing recorder at primary school.
Yeah.
You know, that we should be seeing that level of difference. But at the moment, we're not. And that's a serious, serious issue in our practice.
Yeah. And I mean, you could keep it fairly simple just by recording yourself from time to time and just listening to that, because we often don't realize that we have a certain tick, or that we do something and in the booth while interpreting, and just recording yourself and listening to that can be a humbling experience from time to time as well. I've done it myself, so
yeah.
But of course, getting a mentor would be even better.
I've had to stop myself in French with especially French speakers who repeat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase "comme j'ai déjà dit."
Yeah,
I say that so many, and I've had to be aware of, let's stop saying that, because not every speaker is repeat. And, you know, it's a standard filler. And I've realized, actually, okay, let's make sure my fillers are varied and I'm not just saying comme j'ai déjà dit every single time, because that would get boring. and things like, you know, if you're interpreting from French, you need to practice making sure that you catch negations, because they will catch you out. Ne plus en plus.
Yeah.
Yes. It's going to happen to you at some point. Play as much French as you possibly can so that you never trip. And you know, I mean, I've been in the booth with experienced interpreters who've tripped over negations. It's like, we all do it. Let's just drill it so that we don't do it anymore. You know, it's really basic stuff.
Yeah, well, but at least we do it less often. I mean, nobody's perfect after all.
Or we just do it and recover quickly. I tell people that you can tell an experienced professional where it's not they make less mistakes, it's just they recover from them better.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember I was doing some teaching for some church interpreters in Germany, and the light bulbs just went on when I said to them, you know, you should be self-monitoring, and they went... And I was teaching them, you know, the effort models, which is Daniel Gilles.
Yeah.
Fairly basic interpreting practice, and because they'd never had training... The idea that they could control their attention just blew their minds.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, hold on a minute. We take that as basics, but how many of us are actually practicing what we would say, oh, come on, that's, you know, that's first semester training. Well, okay, are we practicing it?
Yeah, that's true.
I like to ask difficult questions, because I've found that I've had so many coaches and mentors and people helping me, and the sad thing is, until someone asks you an uncomfortable question, you're probably not growing. It's when someone asks you, okay, but why are you doing that? Or do you think that's the best course of action? Or what's the outcome of that? I've not got it in the book, but I think I'm going to blog soon about, you know, if it's not working, that means you have to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, if interpreters being underpaid, it means we need to change something.
Of course.
But it's not something that we don't like to confront, the fact that some things aren't working. Well, let's confront that. Let's change them. And let's move on.
Maybe a last question in this context. I don't know if you discuss it in the book, but what is your take on the role of professional associations and all this, such as the ITI or AIC or others? I mean, it's just improving things just in general.
I have an entire chapter on that, funnily enough. And I chose to interview the chair of ITI, Ewan Davis, for the sole reason that ITI is unique, that it brings together freelancers, few staffers, and agencies. Now, I know people criticize professional associations for that, but for me, the role of a strong professional association is to speak for the profession as a whole. And that, to me, includes the interests of those who are employing us, because they're people too.
Yeah.
And when we speak for an entire industry, we have a louder voice than we do when we just say, okay, we're going to be a glorified union and defend our plot. For me, professional associations need to do two main things. One, they need to be a community of practice. So encouraging people to hold the values of the profession, encouraging people to practice, encouraging people to develop and rewarding that by some kind of status increase. And the other thing that they need to do is they need to be a voice of the industry as a whole. There's something, it's wonderful to have conference interpreting associations, it's wonderful to have public service interpreting associations, that's great. But I think the stronger professional associations are going to be the ones that can stand up to government or to the commission or to anyone else and say, okay, here is what is happening in the translation and interpreting industry, or even just the interpreting industry as a whole.
Hmm.
Here are the industry trends. Here are where, you know, it's in the interest of our clients to have strong, qualified, fully developed interpreters. And the clients who are hiring cheap ones, they get found out soon enough. I mean, the good clients. If we can speak, if the professional associations can speak for the good clients and the excellent interpreters,
mm-hmm.
then actually they'll be saying the same things anyway. All the really good clients are saying an awful lot of the things that we should be saying. You know, where's the development going? Where's the value going? How do we find... There's a desperate need in interpreting for a reliable way to find a good interpreter,
yeah.
whatever the language pair. We need far better signs of not just, you know, did they pass an exam 3 years ago, but how good are they today?
Yeah, exactly.
We need some sort of dynamic way of telling people, you know, okay, Joe Smith qualified 5 years ago, but you know what, he's gone off the rails. But, you know, Peter Hughes only qualified a year ago, but I tell you what, he's amazing. He's on the ball.
Yeah.
That kind of signalling is what clients need to have, and there is no method of doing that at the moment. You know, you could say they're IEC or they're ITI registered, but yeah, okay, they got in 10 years ago. What does that tell you about today?
It doesn't necessarily mean all that much, especially to outsiders or to clients. It's true.
Yeah. And so I think the professional associations can create those signalling mechanisms and can push the values of the industry and saying, this is what it means to be a professional. I've got an entire page on what it means to be a professional interpreter.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
And that's where I think if they can speak out for our profession and relate to outsiders, and if they can create a community of practice and keep building them, I think professional associations will keep on going for a long, long time. If they start defending their own territory, if they start just saying we're basically unions, they're going to have a problem, because the vast majority of interpreters are business people, not staff. And the dynamic between a business person and their client is not the same as between a member of staff and their boss.
Yeah, definitely true. All right. Jonathan, do you know already when the book will be out in stores?
Not yet. I should get it. I'm going to ask for an estimate next week, but it's going to be in the first half of next year, I would imagine in the spring.
Excellent. I think we all have something to look forward then.
Yep, I'm hoping to launch it live at an upcoming conference, but I'll get more details out on that as soon as I can.
Excellent. Meanwhile, you can make sure to follow Jonathan on Twitter.
And LinkedIn.
And probably on other platforms as well. Or you can probably see him at the occasional conference here and there. Anything you've planned for the rest of this year?
Well, in September, I'm doing a seminar on interpreting for Bible translators. There's a big long story behind that, because more and more cultures more and more cultures are needing things in their language but don't have a written language. So what are you going to do? You're going to have interpreters. And to work effectively with interpreters and work out how to train them when you don't have nice Bosch or Braille booths. You know, how do you train them when there's no equipment? Well, you need to think about that.
Yeah. Then thank you very much, Jonathan, for having taken the time.
Okay.
This was a very interesting conversation. I'm sure the listeners will agree.
I hope so.
That's the end of this episode. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.